We're going to begin by looking at the 19th century tonight. And let me just say, I'm going to go in a little less detail on some of these things tonight, but just because we're moving a little bit quicker. And, you know, we happen to have 12 chapters of the book and 11 weeks in training you this semester. So we had to double up here. I felt like, I just strategically felt like this is the best place to double up, though, right? Is here at the end. More modern. So part of what we recognize that develops in the 19th century is what we now call the modern missions movement. So missions, sort of as we know it, was not as popular of a notion in some of the intervening centuries of the Christian church. Did y'all notice that Whitney went down the hall, the baby stopped crying? It's because she's wonderful. Just her very presence calms people down. Of course, the alarms are going off now. Sirens are going off, so I don't know what that means, but cool. Let's see. For example, one early pioneer in the modern missions movement was a missionary named William Carey. And William Carey went to India and became a missionary there. And there are others like Adoniram Judson and others that at times we'll have training new classes on missionary biographies, which I love. If you've never read, like, for example, To the Golden Shore about Adoniram Judson, I would encourage you to do so. During this time, also, you have a development called what becomes known as the Second Great Awakening. So this might be a good time for us to talk about the First Great Awakening, which kind of revolved around Edwards and some of those guys, that was a lot more theological in nature. You heard me read from some of Edwards' sermons, and you can look at some of Edwards' teaching and everything else. He was deeply theological, as were a lot of the other key figures in the First Great Awakening. So it was a revival that happened there. The Second Great Awakening was less marked by theology, so to speak, and depth, and more marked, I mean, this is generally speaking, but was more marked by emotional response and that sort of thing. And emerging, the kind of contrast between those two movements has kind of led us to two terms that we use to describe some of these things. One is revival, and I think we all know what we mean when we talk about revival. Maybe just toward a definition of revival would be a unique movement of the Spirit of God leading to new converts and a renewed emphasis on walking with Jesus in holiness among believers. That's a revival. That's something God does. In contrast, we talk about revivalism, okay? Revivalism. And everyone in this room, you may not have experienced revival, but you've experienced revivalism. I don't know exactly how many verses of the invitation we get through before it becomes revivalism when nobody's come down yet, but I know once you get 10 or 15, you're there, okay? Have anybody ever been there before where you think, okay, I think we can quit now, right? I don't know. I mean, or you're just thinking, I think I'm going to go down there just to see if we can get this over with. We can go home, you know? But revivalism is marked by, of course, I'm not anti adding a verse or two to make sure that everyone's ready to come down, especially people have come down. But revivalism is marked by appeals to emotion and appeals to and sort of disingenuous means to try to make revival come about. So if you've ever we know it when we see it, don't we? When sometimes somebody gives a stirring message and you feel moved by it, and if people respond, you think, man, I feel like the Lord's reviving our hearts. And then we've all been in a situation where we heard somebody just keep on and keep on and keep on, and you feel kind of manipulated, and you feel like you might need to take a shower when you get home. And that's a little bit more what revivalism would be. And you see some of that developing through Charles Finney and others. In the Second Great Awakening, there was less of an emphasis on theology, more of an emphasis of feeling, and more of an emphasis on an emotional response to the gospel. Right? Now, let me just say, I think having some level of emotional response is important in our Christian lives. Right? We're emotional people. It's a good thing to have passion. It's not a bad thing to be moved emotionally. So, you know, people might hear me downplay emotion a little bit and be like, of course, you're a pastor at a Baptist church. Of course you don't like and you don't like emotion, and you've been to seminary and all this kind of stuff, and it's killed your soul. No, I mean, I'm real passionate about seeing people be passionate, right? And I think our affections, as Edwards did, need to be moved by the truth of the gospel. But what I don't want to do is be satisfied with a superficial emotionalism rather than a genuine movement of the affections of the heart. Does that make any sense? We've all seen people respond emotionally to Christianity. I'll tell you what, I can't begin to tell you how many times I had an emotional response to Christianity before I was saved. Tons and tons of times. Deeply moved emotionally, but not moved by the Holy Spirit. My affections didn't change. I never get seeing the Passion of the Christ when I was lost and feeling guilt and shame and sadness and inspiration and a desire to change. And I wept and cried and everything else and yet wasn't saved, right? Didn't genuinely have a change of heart. And so that's one example. Not that there's anything wrong with the movie or anything else like that. Or there's nothing wrong with having an emotional response. But we don't want to have a merely emotional response, right? You ever known someone who's in sin and you think they're going to repent? And you think they're going to repent? And you get to the point where he's like, I know you're crying, I know you're acting emotional, but I need to see some evidence, right? We've all been there with someone probably at some point or another. Same kind of thing is true. So the second Great Awakening was more geared toward emotion, less geared toward any sort of focus on the mind or theology. And so what happened was a couple of things. First of all, it fizzled out a lot faster. And second of all, it bred a lot more error as well. So Mormonism emerged after the Second Great Awakening. Several different heresies developed after the Second Great Awakening because you had people get caught up in a religious fervor, but they weren't really discipled in the truth. So it's just something to remember. Also during this time, you have the advent in earnest of theological liberalism. I mentioned this last week. Again, I want us to be really careful when we think about theological liberalism, that we don't just associate it with modern political liberalism. That's not necessarily the same thing. During this time, or that you have the effects of a philosopher, kind of maybe one idea we need to remember in all of this is this thought an author said several years ago: ideas have consequences. And one idea that had consequences in the 19th century were the ideas of Immanuel Kant. K-A-N-T, Immanuel Kant. And Kant envisioned the world divided in two contexts. One is the phenomenal, and the other is the noumenal. Okay, so think about it like this. Think about it like the world is a house with a bottom story and an upper story. Okay, is everybody with me? Kant would call the bottom story the phenomenal, and the upper story, the noumenal. Now, when we say something's phenomenal, we kind of use that in slang to mean awesome or great. Well, phenomenal means regarding phenomenon, and phenomenon by their very nature are things you can see, experience, touch, taste, things you can experience with the senses. So, last week we talked a little bit about the Enlightenment. Kant, in the Tales of the Enlightenment, is talking about this phenomenal noumenal divide, and in this supreme belief in reason, begins to say that the phenomenal is what we can understand, that which we can experience with the senses. The noumenal is that which is metaphysical. It's beyond what we can experience with our senses. And so Kant would have seen the noumenal as totally unable to be understood through reason. It's ineffable, the noumenal is. Anything beyond metaphysical. So imagine what a challenge this is, right? I mean, in fact, the modern world we live in is deeply shaped by Kant's thinking, by a phenomenal noumenal divide, a physical metaphysical divide. Because if you think about it, that most people we know that have been raised in a world outside church or whatever else would automatically assume as axiomatic that God is something you just can't quite understand, right? I mean, most people would just assume that. Even some Christians, right, would say, right, I'll give you an example. I like to make a joke sometimes about the fact I'm not very good at math. In fact, I'm terrible at math. I think this is a Nate Bargatze joke, but it is true. I took a class at Sneed called math, And then I took a class. I think I took algebra at the University of Mobile, and I was done with math. Okay, and I begged them. I said, "I'm a theology major. Please let math count as one of my math credits." You know, coming over from Snead, and they counted it. So I'm just not. There's no risk of me being an engineer. No risk of me being anything to do with numbers. So, but I know people for whom math is just really easy. This just comes natural to them. They're really gifted in that. They have an engineering STEM type brain, and I have a words brain. If you couldn't tell. And so, what I always joke about, people talk about math and all the math classes they took in college. I always say I wanted something simple to study. I don't like all this math and physics and stuff. I like the simple stuff, like theology and philosophy. And more than once, somebody with a STEM brain has said, "Well, yeah, you like the stuff that doesn't actually have an answer, right?" That's Kantian logic, right? That anything other than what is practical, anything other than that which is phenomenal, numbers, science, those sorts of things, has no answer. We can't even know it. It's ineffable. That's the way that Kant is in the water, and we don't even realize Kant is in the water. Now, I get what people are trying to say. And if you know me well enough to know what they're really trying to say is, Matt, you like to be able to fake your way through an essay and it not really matter if you quite got the right answer. Okay, I get that. I get what you're trying to say. But that logic is all around us all the time. And so what happens is that emphasis on reason, not only, so it begins not only with people saying to believe in Christianity is unreasonable. What they're saying is, you cannot think about God with reason at all. Reason is only for the phenomenal story of the house, the noumenal story, the metaphysical story. We have to abandon all reason, right, to get there. And therefore, some people would say, people who buy into a sort of secularism, and the secular world we live in right now is kind of the same way, if you can't get there by reason, you can't get there at all, right? So reason becomes sort of God, or at least the rubric for understanding the world, and nothing else matters. That's all there is, was, or ever will be, is reason. And so we cut ourselves off from the second story, focus only on the first story. Well, you can see this preoccupation with the first story is deeply problematic for human society after the 19th century, because there are things that we cannot make sense out of through sheer materialism, through sheer reason. There are a lot of things we hold dear, right? There are things we hold dear. There are things our secular American friends hold dear that cannot reasonably be arrived at without some understanding of metaphysics. All men are created equal, right? We believe that instinctively in our country. There is nothing that's not metaphysical that leads us to be able to say that. There's no grounds for saying that in the material universe, right? The world, I mean, nature is red in tooth and claw. Nature is survival of the fittest. We need some sort of a transcendent morality to tell us that we're all equal. Otherwise, whoever's strongest is who's most equal. We give into the Orwellian logic. All people are created equal, but some are more equal than others, right? And you can see the way that logic, once we divorced ourselves from any sort of spiritual reality, you can see the way that logic began to bear horrible fruit in the 20th century. And I've already made reference to Nazi Germany, but that's maybe one example of that. Here's the other thing that happens, though, is Christians then begin to try to reckon with this, is, okay, how do we present Christianity to people who are totally preoccupied with reason, who only want to live in the phenomenal realm? How can we present some sort of a spirituality or a Christianity that can deal with things in a reasonable way? Francis Schaeffer argued in one of his books that there were two wrong-headed responses to this. One was a sort of hard pietism, okay? A sort of hard pietism that took the truth of the gospel for granted, but they just focused on an experiential Christianity. And Schaeffer says that becomes deeply problematic because you don't actually deal with this rampant philosophy of Kant and others. And so you're just focused on a personal experience. And so over time you lose the theology. But there's another group, the theological liberals, who lose the theology on purpose. Okay? So, one, the father of theological liberalism is a guy named Friedrich Schleiermacher. Sounds like a theologian, doesn't he? A German theologian. He's the father of theological liberalism. I'm going to read to you a little bit from Schleiermacher really quickly. In order to make quite clear to you what is the original and characteristic possession of religion, it resigns at once all claims on anything that belongs either to science or morality. Ideas and principles are all foreign to religion. If ideas and principles are to be anything, they must belong to knowledge, which is a different department of life from religion. Do you see what Schleiermacher's doing? He's separating the mind from faith. Knowledge is something altogether other than religion, Schleiermacher says. He goes on, to wish to have true science or true practice without religion, or to imagine it is possessed, is obstinate, arrogant, delusion, and culpable error. What can man accomplish that is worth speaking of, either in life or in art, that does not arise in his own self from the influence of this sense for the infinite? In other words, what Schleiermacher's doing is Schleiermacher basically gives in to Kant's philosophy and essentially says what doesn't matter is whether or not we can know. It doesn't matter whether or not we know that the truths, the dogmas, right, the truths of Christianity are objectively true or not. That's not what's relevant, according to Schleiermacher. In fact, what doesn't matter is whether or not the New Testament's even true. Whether or not the apostles, Schleiermacher would argue, even saw these things happen or experienced these things. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. What matters is that they believed that it was true and that they experienced it as true. And so what Schleiermacher understood himself to be doing was divorcing the practice of Christianity, the experience of faith, from the objective truth of Christianity. And what it does is it allows us to abandon any, it allows us to kind of do an end around on Kant's divide in order that it doesn't really matter whether or not you can ascertain God through reason or not. Reason is other than faith. Knowledge has nothing to do with Christianity. Whereas later, many theologians, and myself included, have become very passionate because of their work in insisting that Christianity, God, can be known reasonably. That it's ridiculous to consider that there's a phenomenal noumenal divide, that all is both, right? And that the veracity, the objective truthfulness of Christianity is essential to whether it's true, to whether it matters or not. And so that's something to consider. During this time, you also have the development of German higher criticism that begins to present critiques of the Bible and the truthfulness and veracity of the Bible that do a lot of harm to people's faith in the Bible. And some of those claims still continue to do so today. I think there are good answers to higher criticism. I think they're really good answers. If you've ever struggled with some of that, some of the source theories and things like that in the Old Testament and even in the New, I'd love to sit down and talk with you and walk with you through some of the evidence for the accuracy of the Bible. But again, this helped bolster theological liberalism in the 19th century. During this time, you also have what came to be known as the quest for the historical Jesus, which is a desire to figure out who Jesus actually was, apart from what they saw as the myths of the Bible that surrounded him. And so that was another movement during this time. Also during the 19th century, one of my personal heroes is a Baptist preacher in London named Charles Haddon Spurgeon. I've got a bunch of Spurgeon quotes here because I love Spurgeon. But let me say, if you're interested in Spurgeon at all, I taught a training new class on the life and ministry of Charles Spurgeon a couple years ago. I think those lectures are all available online. So you can go get all the Spurgeon you want. I also have a few seminary papers on Spurgeon if you're interested in that. One on his preaching and one on a couple other things, his life. So if you have any interest in Spurgeon, I can point you to that. One thing I will say is perhaps we'll talk just a moment about the intersection of Spurgeon's theology and evangelical theology in America during this time. Because I was at the high school earlier for a Veterans Day program, and a young man did this sort of dramatic reading of the Gettysburg Address. And I don't know how into historic speeches you guys are, but I'm very into them. And let me just tell you, the Gettysburg Address is mind-bogglingly good. I don't know when the last time you read the Gettysburg Address was, but I would just encourage you to go read it, maybe over Veterans Day weekend. It's really fantastic. I'm a big fan of speeches, obviously, and so I'm real interested in speeches, and I think I've quoted a lot of Churchill speeches over the years. All that being said, I started thinking today, I was just amazed as he read the Gettysburg Address. One of the disservices that Lincoln did to his modern hearers, but the service he did to adding to the beauty of the address was his opening line. What is the opening word? Opening words of the Gettysburg Address. You may know. 47 years ago, right? And we just hear 47 years ago. And I know you probably know what that means, but you don't think about it very often because you don't hear 87 years ago every time you do the Gettysburg Address. And when I started thinking about 87 years before the Civil War was the founding of the country, 87 years is not a very long time, is it, guys? 87 years ago was the 1930s for us right now. So when you think about how contemporary
if you're 80 years old, you have lived a third of our constitutional history.
There you go. That's a great point, Dick. 80 years is a third of our constitutional history. Speaking of someone who has a great appreciation for historical speeches, if you are interested in such things, you might talk to Brother Dick after this, who I've heard read some historical speeches at a 4th of July party. And it was magnificent. And so I'm thankful for that. So if you're interested in the founding of this country, Dick Grimes is a good guy to talk to. So it's a good reminder, we are a young country, and 87 years, right? 87 years is not that long ago. I think I keep talking about this, but we were at the World War II Museum a few weeks ago, and you start thinking about 80 years ago, does not feel that long ago, right? The Civil War begins to happen in America, and I was just reminded afresh of how quickly that happened after the founding of America. And so the religious experience of Americans has immensely been impacted by the Civil War. I don't think religion in America has been impacted by anything more than the Civil War. And let me just back that up maybe just a little bit historically, or I won't back it up. I'll let somebody else back it up. There's a famous Christian historian named Mark Knoll. And when I was in college, I read this little book by Mark Knoll. It's a really magnificent book. In fact, I'm kind of using a little bit for my doctoral project. It's called The Civil War as a Theological Crisis. And so it just checked a lot of boxes for me in college. And so if anybody's wondering how I landed Whitney back in the day, it's because I read books like that. You know what I mean? And so Mr. Cool Guy. So anyway, it was like, excuse me, would you like to go have a cup of coffee and discuss the Civil War as a theological crisis? You know, that's just a good way to do it. Anyway, Civil War as a theological crisis. Knoll's thesis is that secularism in America, what we now understand as secularism in America, or maybe I should say the rapid secularization. I've not read it in a while, so I don't want to misquote his thesis. But the central thesis of his book is something essential to this. The rapid secularization of America really began in the aftermath of the Civil War. And what Knoll says is that, and this is really reflected, to come full circle for a moment, in Lincoln's second inaugural address, when Lincoln says, both read the same Bible, both prayed to the same God, right? Should we want to wring our bread from the sweat of other men's faces? And what is Lincoln talking about in his second inaugural? He's talking about the challenge of the fact that both sides prayed to the same God, both sides read the same Bible, and what Knoll says is that this was the first time in American history that a great public debate was waged and that the Bible wasn't the ultimate solution to the debate. That the Bible, and I don't mean this in terms of my view of the scriptures, but practically, in terms of the Civil War, the Bible was found wanting in its ability to reconcile the two sides. And instead of being reconciled through the scriptures, what happens? The bloodiest war in our history, right? I mean, it's horrible. Cataclysm of a war. And so, not only, I mean, wars tend to reshape religion greatly, but the Civil War deeply shaped religion in our country, and has is deeply shaping religion in our country today. Debate around racial issues continues to be one of the great forces of secularization in our culture and society. Lots and lots and lots of research shows that racial issues are leading people away from the church and how the church has handled it and others and all these different kinds of things. So one of the central problems that was tried to be resolved in the Civil War, we're still seeing challenges with in terms of religion in the modern world. So it's part of what I'm writing about, studying, trying to research, get my head around. All being said, a lot of people in today's cultural climate want to blame evangelical theology for the problems of A, slavery, and then B, the racial aftermath of chattel slavery in the United States and the colonies. And of course, in our culture, we know that to be the civil rights issues that were dealt with, Jim Crow and other things like that. People want to blame evangelical theology for that. My argument is that evangelical theology was wrongly used to support sinful systems. And I think, to put this thesis forward, that Spurgeon and the British are a good example of why that's the case. Okay? Because, I think I've alluded to this already in the class, but it bears repeating, Spurgeon and others in Britain that were evangelicals were some of the biggest, not necessarily Spurgeon, but before him, Wilberforce and Newton and others were evangelical Christians who believed essentially what Southern slaveholders believed about the Bible, that were huge proponents for abolition. And in the same way, Spurgeon was a huge proponent of abolition, and it cost him dearly. He sold scores and scores and scores of sermons in America, particularly in the South. And when he spoke out strongly against slavery, his sermons were burned, and he was burned in effigy in Montgomery. In fact, here's a quote from a newspaper in Montgomery, the Montgomery Mail, from the time. "A gentleman of this city requests us to invite, and we do hereby invite all persons in Montgomery who possess copies of the sermons of the notorious English abolitionist Spurgeon to send them to the jail yard to be burned on next Friday, this day week. A subscription is also on foot to buy of our booksellers all copies of said sermons now in their stores to be burned on the same occasion. Does anybody say nay?" And so Spurgeon's selling of sermons went to fund all of his ministries, and they took a big lick in losing the South in that way. So I don't think then that evangelical theology was responsible for slavery, but I think it was used inappropriately. But we can't understand religion in America today and really the history of the Christian church without understanding slavery in the American Civil War. Let me also mention during this time, as theological liberalism makes its way to America and starts to move into institutions in the United States, you also have people then who are working really hard to maintain the faith. And one group of those people are what come to be known as the Princeton theologians. Of course, we would not understand Princeton to be a bulwark of strong evangelical convictional theology today. But in these days, the major universities in America were Christian, and most of their presidents were ministers. And in fact, if you look at the history of, for example, the University of Alabama here in Alabama and the history of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and other theological education, there are a lot of overlap in those areas. I won't bore you with that. Except for one thing. Let me say this. Okay. The first two delegates to the Southern Baptist Convention from Alabama were two men. One was named John Ledley Dagg. He wrote an early Baptist, American Baptist systematic theology. We have it in our church library, by the way, if you're interested in it at all. So Dagg, D-A-G-G, Dagg's theology is well known. His son was named John Francis Dagg, and he was editor of the Christian Index, pastor of several churches, including this church. He was one of the pastors. John Francis Dagg was one of the pastors here at First Baptist Church of Gadsden. Our history book that Dr. Davis wrote, sadly, erroneously says that John Ledley Dagg was the pastor here, but he was near dead and blind at the time that his son was. And so it was written as J.F. Dagg, and it looked a lot like J.L. Dagg, and the historical record has very little on John Francis Dagg and very much on John Ledley Dagg. So in doing some research myself, I think that that's what happened. But the other delegate from Alabama was Basil Manley Sr. Some of you that went to Alabama or know about Alabama, my wife know about Manley Hall there. Basil Manley Sr. is a former president of the University of Alabama, one of the first delegates to the Alabama Baptist Convention. And his son, Basil Manley Jr., was one of the first four professors at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He was in Greenville and later in Louisville, and my seminary alma mater. And so Basil Manley Jr. also wrote the seminary hymn, Soldiers of Christ in Truth or Aid. So those are connections that maybe our church kind of has to those histories and something to recognize. But maybe I say that simply by way of illustration of the way that religion and Christianity and the academy were deeply intertwined in this point of American history. But this is the time when theological liberalism starts to seep into these institutions, begin to peel away from the church and from conservative Christianity, and new seminaries are founded and those sorts of things, including a group that were disciples of the Princeton theologians, eventually leave Princeton to start another seminary. One of those disciples of that group was a man named J. Gresham Machen. And maybe we're coming now up into the 20th century, kind of where we are now. And J. Gresham Machen wrote a wonderful book called Christianity and Liberalism. I've read it. It's phenomenal. And in it, what Machen ultimately argues, Machen, a disciple of the Princeton theologians, he essentially argues that that Christianity and theological liberalism are two different religions. And he argues it very forcefully. During this time, you also have a man on the other end of the 18th century. We're up into the 20th century now, not the 19th, but in the 20th. Probably the most influential theologian of the 20th century was a German named Karl Barth, B-A-R-T-H, but pronounced Barth. Karl Barth was what became known as neo-Orthodox. So what Barth did was recognize the challenge of the problems with theological liberalism, and tried to take a way forward without going all the way back to what we would call orthodoxy, hence the term neo-orthodoxy. So Barth, while helpful in some ways, was unhelpful in others. He understood the Word of God not necessarily to be inerrant, the inerrant Word of God in itself, but he understood that it could become the Word of God through experience, some things like that. One of my favorite theologians, and someone who I credit, even though I never knew him, but his writing I credit for helping form and maybe save my faith in college, was a Baptist named Carl F.H. Henry. Carl Henry was the first editor of Christianity Today. He wrote a book called God, Revelation, and a multi-volume work called God, Revelation, and Authority that helped me. I'll put it like this. I like to buy records. I like to buy like vinyl records. We have a little record player. And sometimes I go down here to Main Street or Broad Street and go to Cosmic Debris. My buddy Carl owns the shop in there. And Carl's a pretty cool hippie guy. He owns a record store. You know what I mean? And so we're talking one day, and it's like, I'm the pastor at First Baptist Church. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah. He's like, what are you doing in here? And I'm like, buying records, you know. And then we start talking. And he's like, he kind of just assumes that I don't believe the Bible's true. You know, just I'm young and everything else. And he was like, how in the world, you know, he didn't say how in the world, but how in the world are you conservative? Like, how do you still believe the Bible's true? And I was like, Carl Henry, man. that's how, you know. When I was in college, I read a book called God, Revelation, and Authority. And it, I got pinned to the mat by a guy that's a lot smarter than me, you know. And I started thinking maybe I was too smart to believe the Bible was true. I had a professor that gave me God, Revelation, Authority, told me to read it. And he gives these 15 theses on the fact God has spoken and why we can trust the Bible, why we should believe that God's revelation is authoritative. And it transformed the way I think and gave me the underpinnings I needed to cut through the secular assumptions I had from just growing up in a secular society, despite the fact I grew up in church, to have the intellectual underpinnings I needed to trust that the Bible's true. It was hugely helpful. So one of my favorite stories is one time Karl Barth was at a in America for something, and there was a little press conference, and it opened up for questions, and different journalists were asking questions, and Carl Henry, before he was really Carl Henry, he was just an editor of Christianity Today, and he raises his hand and says, my name's Carl Henry, I'm with Christianity Today. And Bart says, you mean Christianity Yesterday, you know? And the room erupts in laughter. And Henry says, Christianity Yesterday, Today, and Forever, which is great, you know. All of us little evangelicals love our hero Henry standing up to Bart. And so Henry asks a question that they said Bart refused to answer. It enraged him. He said, if I'm a reporter, I'm a journalist. If I had been present at the tomb on Easter Sunday, would I have had something to report? And Bart got angry and refused to answer the question. So this kind of shows you, though, what I mean by neo-orthodoxy. It's trying to take a good step away from theological liberalism, but still doesn't quite answer the questions that need to be answered. And so during this time, we start to see people responding, okay, responding to theological liberalism. During this time, churches that went more toward theological liberalism became pretty much occupied entirely with changing the world around them. Social impact, right? I won't use the word social justice because it's taken on a lot of weight that a lot of us are uncomfortable with. And so I'll say it was social impact, right? Helping people, helping the poor, all those kinds of things. Things that are important for Christians to do, right? Horizontal change. The liberal, more theological liberal folks became preoccupied with, but not so much evangelism and spiritual change and horizontal. That's not so much it. So what do we do? Just do the most good we can do. At the same time, you have another group that develops during this time as a kind of reaction to some of the challenges in the world. And this is what we would call historic fundamentalism. Historic fundamentalism. So fundamentalism tended more toward separation, not only from the world, but second degrees of separation. That not only can you not be friends with the world yourself, you can't be friends with somebody who is friends with the world, right? So no level of compromise is tolerated in a more fundamentalist environment. It's during this time you have preachers like Billy Sunday. Prohibition develops during this time, large part through advocacy from more fundamentalist groups. And then you also have like the Scopes Monkey Trial during this time that shows this sort of reactionary response to theological liberalism and the advent of Enlightenment thoughts in America. So fundamentalists tended to focus almost exclusively, and fundamentalists tend to focus almost exclusively, I'm speaking in broad terms, but almost exclusively on vertical elements, right? Evangelism, saving souls, right? And not so much on this kind of thing. And there's a real removal from the world. So if you were to say theological liberalism sort of walks in lockstep with the world, acclimates too much to the world, fundamentalism tends to remove itself completely from the world, right? Do not touch, do not handle, do not taste. We better stay away. The world's coming in to get us. During this time, Billy Graham and Carl Henry and others felt the need to develop a movement, a Christian movement, that did something very important, that did what Carl Henry called for in a book that he wrote called The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. It came out in the 30s or 40s. It's a great book, by the way. And Carl Henry there argued that for the first time in Christian history, social impact, horizontal ministry, and evangelism, gospel ministry, were divorced for the first time in the history of the Christian church, right? And what Carl Henry said is, to truly make an impact, we need to have social impact, we need to build hospitals, we need to help people, we need to have dental clinics, right? We need to have mission centers, we need to do those things, we need to advocate. Evangelicals were huge advocates for social reform, first in Britain and then later in America as well. So Henry said, But we can't do that at the expense of preaching the gospel. And he says that's the vision of the apostles. So the evangelical movement, as we know it in America, was a desire to unite social ministry and gospel preaching and impact the culture while maintaining holiness. That's the evangelical movement. And if you think about it, guys, the major debates that are happening across the landscape of Christianity right now, in our own denomination and in others, really fall along these fault lines, right? I've said this for years. The major divide in the Southern Baptist Convention is not what most people say it is. The major divide in the Southern Baptist Convention is primarily whether someone identifies, whether consciously or unconsciously, with either historic fundamentalism or classical evangelicalism. It's really the divide. How will we relate to the culture? If you're curious, you can probably guess. I tend to be a big fan of the classical evangelical movement. People like Henry, obviously Billy Graham, later Jim Packer, John Stott. I read a biography of Stott earlier this year. It was marvelous. Are these great figures in the global evangelical movement that have had a big influence on my life and thinking. And it's something I'm passionate about, is making sure, we talk about this all the time here at First Baptist. We don't want to sequester ourselves off from our community, right? We want to preach the gospel. We want to see souls saved, but we want to make Gadsden a better place too, right? We think the gospel has a horizontal impact. And we want to advocate for righteousness in lots of different ways, not just on hot button issues, but in lots of different ways. So that's, I tend to go more in that direction. A British historian named David Bebbington has tried to define what an evangelical is. Next year's an election year, so you're going to hear that word a lot. Evangelical. Believe it or not, this is something that existed before Jimmy Carter ran for president and people realized we were a voting block. And so now we've been reduced to a voting block, but evangelicalism is not primarily a voting category, okay? Some of you probably remember when Carter ran for president, everybody was asking, what in the world is an evangelical when he called himself an evangelical Christian? What is an evangelical? According to Bebbington, this is a rubric that defines evangelicalism, and I think it's helpful. Most people agree with this. Most self-proclaimed evangelicals agree with Bebbington. This is called the Bebbington Quadrilateral, okay? So I think it's a great name. And so it's this, four things. Biblicism is the first definition of an evangelical. That's a particular regard for the Bible. That is, all essential spiritual truth is to be found in the pages of the Scripture. Second of all, the definition of evangelical. Biblicism, second of all, crucicentrism. That is, a focus on the atoning work of Christ on the cross. Cruci, meaning cross, cross-centered. Biblicism, crucicentrism. Third of all, conversionism. The belief that human beings are lost and need to be saved. Okay, that's a hallmark of evangelical Christianity. And then finally, activism. The belief that the gospel needs to be expressed in effort. We ought to do something. And when you think about it, all four of these things here at First Baptist Church, most of us, all four of these things are the things we believe and hold to implicitly, right? I mean, it just makes sense to us. In fact, to even try to define that feels a little weird to us, doesn't it? Because it's just what we are. You prick us and we believe these things. Nope, I never have to come up on Sunday morning and say, now listen, y'all, I'm going to preach today. And when I get done, it's important that you do something with it. You know, it almost sounds silly for me to say, right? We understand ourselves. We need to get off our blessed assurance and do something, don't we? And that's what we need to do. So we all recognize that. So that's what an evangelical is, we would say. And so I think it's important to remember and important to understand. And moving forward, it's helpful when people are talking about what evangelicals are and what evangelicals do. That's the case. Let me tell you what for me, just in my experience as a pastor, where I find I can jee-haw with just about anybody. Just, hang out, have lunch, talk, have a conversation with just about anybody. But as far as having Christian fellowship with other ministers in town, I'll tell you where I realize my breakdown on whether or not I can genuinely feel like I have a gospel partnership with someone. It really basically usually, the lead indicator for me is normally conversionism, right? Conversionism. That's usually, for me, the telltale sign of someone who's generally on board with the Bible or generally not is whether or not they think people need to be saved. And so I'll talk to somebody sometime that's different than me on a lot of issues, right? On all kinds of a host of issues. But I'm usually more, let's just say, probably more conservative than them on 10 or 12 biblical issues. I mean political issues, biblical issues. But then, you know what? They think people need to be saved. And I'm like, I can usually jihad with that. You know what I mean? But once people stop to believe, stop believing in sin, stop believing in the need for salvation, that's where they lose me, you know? And I just don't think we're going to have much fruit from our relationship. Okay, let me just conclude with this. We've walked with the church for a long time, and there are plenty of other people to talk about. I might encourage you to consider Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who stood up against the Nazis. I might get you to consider thinking about the impact of postmodern philosophy in modern days on theology and everything else. But let me just say this. I think people are nervous about the future of the church. I think people are nervous about the future of the church. And I understand why. Because if you look at the religious landscape of the place in which we live, that's historically been so robustly Christian, and you see the way that Christianity is eroding here in the United States and in other Western countries, it can be really terrifying about the history of the church. Because we kind of grew up believing, whether or not we really knew it or not, we kind of grew up being told that the center of Christianity is here, right? That the locus of Christianity in the world, the weight of Christianity in the world is kind of here. I've heard people literally say, if we lose the Southern Baptist Convention, we'll lose America, and if we lose America, then Christianity will go away in the world, which is the least Christian thing I've ever heard in my life. Now, I don't want to lose either. Do you know what I mean? But as long as Jesus is alive, he said, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And neither will the gates of a growing secularism. Neither will those things. Here's where I think we can take hope. Does Christianity seem to be in decline in the West? Sure. Are there hopeful signs of re-reaching the West for Christ? Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think developing a fresh fundamentalism is going to be the answer to that. Going off into Christian ghettos and removing ourselves from the culture, I don't think that's going to be the answer. But re-engaging the West is important. I think I've told you guys a little bit about this. This is part of what I'm writing my doctoral project on, is evangelistic preaching in light of a changing South. And trying to evaluate and understand. And I mean, I found some fascinating things about the way our culture here in the Bible Belt is changing drastically, right? And how do we re-evangelize the South, much less America, much less the whole West? But let me just tell you this, folks. Christianity is exploding around the globe. We feel like we're losing here sometimes, but God is winning in the world, okay? There are more Christians in China right now than there are in the United States. And the number is growing. Now, maybe that's not what we want for here, but isn't that encouraging to think? Somewhere that 20 or 30 years ago, we would have imagined Christianity would be totally eradicated in a place like China by now. On top of that, this is 15 years ago, I learned that places in the 1040 window where Christianity is illegal are being evangelized, because in the desire to build in these oil-rich countries, they are bringing in migrant workers from around the world to build their great building projects. And one of the countries that they get workers, cheap migrant workers from, is China. And so people are coming in from China who happen to be believers and leading people to Jesus in the Muslim world, in places where Christianity is illegal. Right now, we worry about the way mainline churches are declining and going toward liberalism. Right now, the African Diocese of the Church of England is sending missionaries to North America to plant churches through the Anglican Church in North America, ACNA. Because vibrant mainline Christianity, theologically conservative Christianity, is thriving in Africa and in other places. And so the people who are advocating or saying that Christianity is in decline or in demise simply just don't know the ways that God is at work in the world. I'm hopeful about here, and I'm hopeful about the fact that God's still at work, and I hope you will be too. Remember this, there are ups and downs, there are highs and lows, but the reality is Jesus said, I will build my church. And what we can do is we can continue to love, to serve, to pray, to give, in order to do that right here at First Baptist Church Gadsden, and in doing so, we do that around the world. And so thank you all so much for being a part of the class, and if you have any questions, I'll be around. Never forget that the Lord Jesus will build his church. Thank y'all. Appreciate you so much. Thank you. Go in peace.